We're here now with Michael Gaynor, who's also running for mayor on the independent ticket. And so, like with everybody else, we want to get into talk about the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And first, I'm going to kind of tell you the way I understand the budget, and then you can correct me or elaborate or agree or whatever. And then we can start talking about how you see the budget. So the way I understand it is it's both similar and dissimilar to like your typical family budget. And first the mayor projects out the projected revenue and then the projected expense for the upcoming year.
Mm-hmm.
Sends that off to the common council where it gets approved. And then what happens is we get partway through the year and realize that those numbers were completely wrong and we've overspent and undercollected, and then we're, you know, dipping into cash reserves, asking for money, borrowing money wherever we can get it. And we are now at the point where there is no longer any money to get at. The cash reserves are gone. And so that is what has brought this topic to the fore, I guess, in this particular mayoral election. So I want to open it up by getting into more detail about that process as it exists with you, how you understand it, what it's, you know, how it operates or doesn't operate, and then we can get into moving forward.
For sure. Let's do it. I think that, you know, the process as you laid it out is pretty clear. I don't think that, you know, they made some modifications to the process a year ago where they actually now they increased the window where the city council can deliberate. But I don't think that budgeting and creating budgets and managing budgets is a one-time-a-year prospect. Like, it is something that is ongoing. And I think that what we learned from last year's budget is should advise how we create the next generation's budget or the next year's budget. And it should be a process that's constantly evolving. If we look at what we've learned over the last 6 years, right? And as we look at revenue projections and we look at costs, we've learned that for many years, we weren't collecting the tax revenue that we needed. For many years, we were underestimating overtime expenditures and consistently did that same thing over and over again when those expenses were running over what was budgeted. Where, you know, sales tax kind of varies and state kind of, but those are more consistent and reliable. But our expense structure has changed also because you see increases in pensions and increase in healthcare expenses and the fringe benefit component of the pie, which is almost a third of our expense burden, keeps increasing. So what I'm trying to get to is that, you know, we treat budgeting and the budget process as kind of a one-time-a-year thing when really it needs to be ongoing. And each year, instead of just reacting to a situation, we should be trying to plan for the problems that we've had in the past. We should be using our past budget cycles as an opportunity to learn and revisit and talk to department leads and problem solve and figure out how we address the issues that are going on. It's also an opportunity for the mayor's office to look at the goals and objectives for each of those departments. And are we meeting those goals and objectives? Do we have the staffing we need to meet those goals and objectives? Do we have surplus staff? Do we have people sitting in offices on disability that can't do their primary job but could do other jobs? Are we overburdened as a police force and therefore we need to hire more cadets? And that's why our overtime burden is higher. Like it's not an opportunity to just create numbers and fill in an Excel spreadsheet. It's an opportunity to problem solve. And I think that that's what is missed in the whole conversation about budgets. You know, I did many, many budgets over the last 20 years. Trying to project revenues, trying to project expenses. And I'll tell you, now it's even harder because there's a lot more unknowns in the world, particularly with what's happening in the federal government. That reverberates down to the state government, which reverberates down to the local government. And there's going to be more challenges, which means that we need to be on top of our game. We have to be diligent about looking at what the current needs of the city are and where we're missing the boat and directing our resources accordingly. And I just don't believe that we have been diligent in that process over the last 20 years. Because we have gotten here. We've gotten to this place where we have a structural budget deficit. That didn't happen over 1 year's time. You know, when I'm looking at my cash flow projections and my costs and my business, I do that every week. Like every week, I have a revenue projection for how much money I'm going to bring in. And I'm checking every week if that money is coming in. And I know that at the end of that week, if I only brought in $20,000 and my expense burden is $30,000, that there's a problem. And then either I have a whole bunch of strategies that I go through. I talk to my staff. What happened this week? Do we have, you know, receivables that we didn't collect that aren't in our coffers now because it's a work that we did, but we haven't received it yet? Okay. Or did costs go up? You know? So like, and if it is costs going up, like, what are we going to do about that? All right. Our rent went up 25%. Well, that was that in the contract? Was that in the lease agreement? Oh, we don't know. Well, then we have to go back and talk to that, the landlord or that vendor. It's a process of problem solving. And it's ongoing. It's not like, okay, it's March. We got to look at the budget numbers. Oh, we don't want to increase taxes this year because it's an election year. So I guess we're just going to have to ride it out and try to be creative and punch the numbers and see where we end up. Like, no, it is an ongoing process. And it keeps me up at night because I'm responsible for 25 families in my business. So if I'm not doing that, like I'm cutting those people short and I'm compromising on my ability to do my job effectively and to deliver the services that create my business and sustain my business. The city budget is no different. Mm-hmm. So we've been saying for many years that there's too much overtime in police and fire. I'm not going to just create a referendum on overtime. What I want to do is use the fact that we have 6 years of overexpense as a conversation point to talk to the police and fire commissioner and say, consistently, we've budgeted this much and consistently we're over by almost 100% or more every year. Like, what's going on? Like, what can we improve? Why are we in this place? Because that ultimately, when we're spending that much more on overtime, that if that overtime burden is in people that are at the end of their career, which it often does, right? That increases our pension burden, which is also our fringe benefits. So it all contributes to an increased cost burden to the city budget and an increased burden because we weren't proactive. We are always reacting here in this city. We are always reacting to crisis situations. I have never experienced a year where we weren't in that position in one way or another. There needs to be a thoughtfulness, and we have to be proactive, and we have to be strategic, and we got to think out, not next year, out 5 years, out 15 years. So I have a short-term strategy, which is to look at these department situations. I know that permits and inspections is overburdened because we're not doing our job. We're not inspecting tenant housing and rental housing. And consequently, we have deplorable conditions for many of our residents. That's unacceptable to me. It is not acceptable because we're burdened in one department and because we don't have enough money that people have to live in squalor. That's not okay. So, and I've known this for 15 years. So like, where is the attention to detail to address that problem? Meanwhile, I look at the budget and I go through the budget and I don't know what happens every day in the mayor's office. I haven't been there. So maybe 22 staff is legitimate. But if I think about it, I think 22 staff in the mayor's office is insane because it's a big city, but I would rather have a streamlined mayor's office and put more resources into making sure people are living in quality housing. I would rather, if there are staff members that are on our firefighter or police force that are on disability and they're collecting a check, I would rather cross-train them to do some inspections because that's in the best interest of the fire department. Now, these are solutions that are coming out of my brain as a manager that has always trying to innovate and do things, do more with less. All of my staff are cross-trained. People run equipment, people do demo, my carpenters can do everything, you know, my store staff can do everything, and that's because I need to be nimble and creative all the time. Firefighters do a lot of different things. And if obviously people get hurt and they can't be on active duty, but they still have a brain and they still have an investment in making sure the rest of their firefighting team, right, don't die in fires. Well, unsafe housing leads to fires. It does. When I sold my house at Glenwood and Maston, or I the next day after I bought that property, I walked in. There were tenants in there the previous week. I never did a walkthrough through those two apartments. There's wires hanging out, you know, behind drywall, you know, wires that are matched. And anybody with just a little bit of common sense could walk in and make a determination, safe or unsafe. Are there holes in the floor, holes in the walls? We can train staff that may be available in other departments to do that type of work. And then if it's unsafe, we hand it on to the inspectors that really know the codes. And then if there are fines and penalties, we need to be diligent enough about collecting those, which we just saw a report yesterday from Housing Court where there's $15 million or $12 million that was left on the table that we never collected in fines and penalties from people that weren't paying their fines that were mandated by Housing Court.
I want to go back for a minute to something you said earlier, and that is talking about the budget. Like we're talking about overtime. Let's just go back to that. The part of the way I see it is that you can go back and let's say I don't know how solid the information is in Buffalo. Like how much is kept and how much can actually be reviewed from prior years. Maybe you can elaborate on that, but. If year after year we're saying, for example, the overtime budget is, let's just pick random numbers, the overtime budget is going to be $5 million for the fire department, and every year it's actually somewhere between 12 and 15. So to me, that's less than saying, that's also, the question is also not just going to the commissioner and saying what went wrong, but also like, weren't we lying for the past 6 years probably? Like we knew, like every year if it's $12 million and we say every year it's going to be five, then isn't this whole process just a show? And so how do we like, and I guess is that how it actually gets through by just sort of making up these numbers? And so how do you stop that cycle and actually say, okay, we're going to use real numbers for the next year going forward. And then what does that actually mean? Like, does that actually mean you have to say, you brought up the mayor's office, for example, that means we're going to have to go down from 22 to six.
I think that you need real numbers. I mean, the thing is, when I was starting not-for-profits, I had no idea where the money was coming from, you know? The budgets were in some ways made up because you don't know. Like, you know that you need a certain number of people to do the business that you're starting. But when you've been running a city government, you have those numbers and that history. What has been lacking is discipline and an ability for leadership to look acutely at each department and strategically at each department and hold commissioners accountable for those numbers. And I don't see much accountability. I have not seen much accountability in our party structure, in the political machine structure, in our city government structure. I haven't seen it. You know, the comptroller and the mayor's office and the city, the common council largely walk in step with each other and rubber stamp every budget. And there are some tweaks and, you know, some shifts around the side and around the margins. But in general, they all agree. You know, and to me, that's not healthy governance. Like, In a not-for-profit structure, you have a board of directors that scrutinizes and asks questions and pushes the envelope and inquires and, you know, and tries to problem solve. And then we'll go out and raise some money if they need to. And I think that though city government is much different, like there's lessons there, and that's kind of the role of the council, to be that checks and balances, to do that number crunching, to meet with the comptroller and get, you know, more hard figures and numbers and analysis. And then to also question those commissioners and department heads. Like Jeff Kelly has already written about it on the Investigative Post. We're into the first quarter and we're over budget on all of our overtime expenditures. Okay, because we were last year and the year before that and 6-7 years prior to that, and there was no accountability. So why should we change our procedure and protocols? Like, that's what I'm talking about. And it's just people get comfortable and they can get lazy. Now, there is some bit of optimism in just looking at history and numbers. When I first came to Buffalo back in 2005, we had almost maxed out our debt capacity. You know, I think it's the city charter that mandates that you can't have more than 9% of your overall city valuation in debt. And we had almost capped out that 9%, which as soon as you do that, you know, it's going to affect your bond rating. It's going to affect your borrowing capacity. And you don't have any other place to go at that point. Like, you're in trouble. That's when, you know, when the hard control board was really mobilized to do something. Well, we got lucky, you know, in a citywide level, because right around that time, there were some serious capital investments that were being made, particularly with our schools. Canisius College did a big renovation. Nichols was in the middle of a big capital investment. There wasn't a lot happening in the private sector, but there was some good project. There was some hopefulness that was out there, right? But we are not in that same situation now. Right now, we're at about 7.5% of our debt cap, 7.5%. Of that 9% man. So we have about $150 million in debt. Now, $150 million is a lot of debt. I'm not saying that it's not significant, but I'm saying that we are in a position where we have some tools at our disposal, but I don't want to just borrow money without a plan, without a strategy, without discipline, and without accountability. You know, it is a big picture approach, and the plan needs to be how we bring in more money ultimately. Like, where are we leaving money on the table right now? You know, that's got to be the question. You know, I look downtown and I look at parking lots, which are basically cash cows, and we don't get hardly any tax revenue from those at all. And I'm looking at how the 2019 valuation of the city reassessment gave a lot of our neighborhoods big tax decreases while burdening, you know, neighborhoods that were building and growing and kind of won that assessment lottery, if you can say it that way. So how do we bring more tax equity? Because we still need to lean into our tax revenue, a property tax revenue, but we have to do it in a way that doesn't further burden people that have already been burdened. But I don't know what all those answers are in terms of where we're leaving money on the table, because I don't have all of those insights. I just can look at budgets and I can look at news stories and I can look at history and I can start to, in my own way, as just a person that's very pragmatic, you bring in more money than you spend. Like, that's always been my rule. And if you're not doing that, you need to make some significant readjustments. And I haven't seen anybody talk about that. And I hate to be the one that's the bearer of bad news that, you know, we may need to, you know, either remove some positions or shift some positions or just systematically think about how we do business differently. And I think that that's what's, it's unique about me coming in there is that, you know, I have been nothing but nimble and frugal and creative about how I've funded big ideas and big expenditures over the last 20 years. And I think we need that approach. We need to bring together really smart people that are know a lot more about municipal finance than me, at least a consulting team or people to our finance committees and finance department. But we also just need to bring a different perspective and a different culture. I talk about it on my platform, a culture of care. How do we, and part of that caring is making sure that we have the money to deliver the services that people are paying for. You know, I had people over the last 6 months tell me I'm happy to pay more as long as my streets consistently get paved, as long as I'm not having to spend $2,000 on car repairs because I commute down Main Street and it destroyed my car last year. So I think that that's where we need to put our focus. And then long term, we have to grow the city. We've got to grow the budget. And we do that by bringing more people here. We have all of the pieces. They just haven't been assembled in a way and projected to the world in a way that people look at Buffalo and think, that's a place that I need to be. It's a cool city. It's a creative city. It's a city on the grow. It's a city that's doing neat, interesting, innovative things. That's where I want to be. And, you know, when you bring tourism here, more people, and I'm encouraged by Visit Buffalo and Niagara's vision to start marketing nationwide to bring tourists here, then you start to get more, $1.5 billion more in downtown investment or investment on Elmwood Avenue or on Niagara Street or on Hurdle, because you have all of these new visitors coming here that weren't coming here before. They're coming to go to the museums. They're coming to see our fully restored Olmsted Parkway system. They're coming here for a business plan competition. They're coming here for conferences and conventions on architecture and arts and creative problem solving. And, you know, we're going to bring people here because we're going to be doing things differently. It's not just a pie in the sky. Like, you know, I mentioned, and I probably in a previous interview, talking to Bill Johnson, the previous mayor of Rochester. And people, when he implemented Neighbors Building Neighborhoods, people came from all over the country. They came from all over the world to learn from him and to see what he was doing, because it was innovative, it was outside of the box, and it empowered communities, and people want that. People that care about their communities, they care about the long-term vision, they want that. But you need to have an intention, and you have to have a vision for that, or it just doesn't happen. If it's just like, well, we'll borrow our money and we'll, you know, figure things out and we'll increase taxes over the next 10 years and, you know, hopefully it all works out, because that's usually how it works out. Well, yeah, but we're not a usual case. We're a struggling Rust Belt city with a declining population, or at least, at the very least, a stagnant population. But we were once a city of 600,000. How do we start heading in that direction again? Because we have the physical geography here to support it. We have the amazing communities here to support it. And we need to set a goal of building. If you're always trying to save and, you know, crimp and, you know, and punch, you know, and whatever it's called, the expression, whatever. I just need to take a break, I guess. But the point is that if you're always trying to cut costs and minimize your expenses and meet the budget, and you're not thinking visionary, and you're not thinking about how to improve systems and raise more money and grow the city, then you're just stagnant. And what have we been for the last 20 years? We've been largely stagnant.
I want to touch on there's a few things I wanted to get to, and you've started to touch on them. And so I'm going to combine a few things here. So there is this, there's the revenue and then there's expense. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, I think everybody's going to have a slightly different opinion on whether or not we've got a revenue issue or an expense issue, but I think there's some truth to both. Mm-hmm. So how do we get to a point, or how can we get to a point where there's enough revenue in the city to make it work, number one? And with that, one of the things I've been curious about, and I wonder if there's numbers on this, is simply the number of properties that are not on the tax rolls, vacant mm-hmm. land, city-owned property. How do we, like, really get those off the back onto the tax rolls? And that's a complicated issue because in order to do that, you also need people.
Right.
And then the other thing that I think ties into this, which you've mentioned, is fines and fees, and it's something that I'm kind of interested in. There's a lot of talk now about the amount of money that is currently uncollected in fines and fees. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a flip side to fines and fees that I feel like is, I think it also is a system that unfairly burdens people mm-hmm. of, you know, that don't have the income to necessarily pay those fines and fees. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we say, yeah, there's X amount of money in fines and fees, but were those ever collectible?
Right.
You know, certainly some of them are, but I think it's more nuanced. So,
yeah, I mean, I think I am, the fines and fees strategy is a reactive response to a budget that's in crisis, right? It's, we got to figure out other ways to raise money. So they double licensing fees, they increase permit fees. You know, we have some of the highest parking fees in the country. You know, all of these fees are just taxes. They're just taxes. And the other thing is that they are really, they largely heavily burden people that are regular people that are on fixed incomes that don't have extra money to just be paying. It's up to $85 for a parking ticket if you don't pay it in the first week, you know, and sometimes you don't even ever see it, you know. So I think that the fee structure is not a healthy way to think about growth. It is a reactive and irresponsible way of generating revenue. And I think that what we need to look at is overall how we increase the valuation of our city. So yes, there's a lot of vacant land, right, that could be on the tax rolls. And I think that that fits into a long-term strategy in terms of how we redevelop some of our communities. But I also think that there's the double edge of that sword is that you could be like, well, we're just going to sell a bunch of vacant land and, you know, and try to bring in some revenue and get stuff back on the tax roll. But then it doesn't fit into a plan or a strategy for how we best plan and grow our neighborhoods. And I think that there is, we got to be cautious about that. Like I have been a huge critic of the Byron Brown administration and them hoarding land. You know, their planning development, you know, planning department will say that it was, you know, land banking. That's not land banking. It's hoarding. If you don't have a plan and a strategy for getting that property into productive use. And that's exactly what happened over the last 20 years. They did not have a plan. They were extremely ineffective at closing on properties and getting properties, you know, on the tax rolls and generating revenue that way. So, but that's also because they didn't do a lot in terms of economic development, you know, across the city, you know, and really looking strategically on how to invest in specific areas, downtown corridor in a specific zone, or Grant Street in a 6-block area, or Jefferson Avenue, or Bailey, you know, and just strategically leveraging the state investment to do things more creatively and to build valuation in those areas of the city and build livability in those parts of the city. The reality is, I've gotten this information from a lot of people that that are in the real estate industry is that people come here to Buffalo and want to buy houses, but not everybody wants a fixer-upper. You know, not everybody wants to move in and have to, you know, over the next 5 years, rehab the second floor unit. People just want to live in a house and maintain the house. And when you look at it, there's not a lot on any given day of houses in the, you know, 200 to 350 price range that are turnkey, ready to go, livable, and desirable homes. So, like, I think that we need to look at that challenge and that problem because that's holding us back. It's holding us back from really getting more population investment and more population growth in the city, and you know, and starting to curb some of these systemic challenges that we have with revenue projections. You know, another one of that, another ball and chain on that whole process is the Department of Education in the city, and that we would probably have a lot more people moving to the city if we had a more creative and more responsive Department of Ed. We're spending $1.2 billion to educate our kids here. We're spending $30,000 per kid. And, you know, we still don't have the outcomes that we really need to have in terms of young people that are reading level on and young people that are at grade level for math. And I think that that's a whole nother conversation that I can't directly affect, but I certainly can frame the conversation. And that's what I fully intend to do over the next 8 years, is to frame the conversation and educate people about where we're missing the boat educationally. I'm an educator. I worked in education. I worked in public schools and private schools. I worked in vocational schools. I worked in all kinds of alternative schools that were dealing with kids because they failed in a traditional school environment. So I have a lot to say about it, and it's not for this podcast, but if we don't think about it and talk about it and articulate the challenges and start to put pressure on and hold our school board accountable and hold our superintendent accountable for certain educational outcomes, we're going to struggle as a city. We're going to struggle to attract talent, to retain talent, to get people to invest in homes here, to get people to invest in the city, in the future. So it's hard because I don't have mayoral control over the school board. I don't think I want it. But I do have a lot of things to say, and I think that as residents, we can contribute to that conversation. You know, I'm going to support innovative educators on the school board, and I'm going to help them win. Because people care about good education. They care that their kids have access to technical training so that when they graduate from high school, they at least have a strong skill, you know, and can access all the training programs. We have to retain kids. You know, you can't just pull out the budget and address the budget, because it's not a thing that can be addressed in a silo. We're not going to address the budget in a silo. We're going to think about how education affects the budget, how planning, how green space, how business growth, all of that is the long-term vision and the big picture vision of how we get out of this mess. But it starts with the things that we're talking about. How do we leverage our strengths? How do we address our most urgent needs? And how do we bring a culture that is focused on discipline and accountability and support of the staff that are doing the work every day? You know, I have, these are the people I've been talking to for the last 7 months. You know, I go into City Hall to pull a permit, or I talk to a sanitation worker on the street, or I run into a cop out on the east side that pulls over and, you know, chats with me, and I'm picking their brain. Like, I'm sponging this information constantly, because those insights inform and advise how we do our jobs better, how we fund their positions, and how we get ourselves out of a rut and more onto a nice, solid, paved, flat, comfortable street that hopefully is directing us, right, towards a healthier, you know, world-class city, which I think we all know is possible, but we just never are thinking about growth and building and, like, you know, leveraging all the amazing assets that were here. We're always stuck in the silo of the numbers, and we have to go there. Don't get me wrong. And we are going to go there, but it's going to be a process that is rolling and ongoing, and it's going to be a process that's focused on problem solving and helping to direct resources where it's needed most.
I think to me, what you're talking about is really a mindset change. I would agree that I think, and I've said this a lot before that Buffalo feels like it's resigned to its place in the world.
Right.
It has been for quite some time. Whereas at one point we were a city that was, you know, we were thinking big, right? It was growing. It was, you know, things were happening here. And we have a lot of nostalgia for that period in time, but we're not thinking that way anymore. We're kind of in this like, yeah, we're always going to be broke. The streets are always going to be bad. Like it's been kind of, so you are talking about really changing the way the city not just operates, but also thinks about itself, which I think is important. And I've seen that you look at other successful cities around the country, and I think you see that in the way they brand themselves, the way they think of themselves. But back to the kind of the boring numbers, I think there are some things like there are some costs that continue to grow within the budget. And what are they, and is there a way of managing those?
Well, the costs that are increasing the greatest are basically our fringe benefits. That 35% of our fringe expense. It's pension costs. It is health insurance costs, or retirement, and you know, for all of our city employees. That's public, police, fire, you know, and all the blue and white collar workers that work at City Hall. That's the area that's been growing the greatest, as well as overtime expenditure. If you look at the last 6 years, you know, I think it's just the last 6 years. If you look at what we've spent on overtime beyond what was budgeted, it's almost exactly what our current structural deficit is, $60 million. And that for me is problematic. And it points to one of two things. Either we don't have the staffing to do the things that we need to do well, or people are taking advantage and there's not enough discipline to hold people accountable for that. And those are the real numbers there. In terms of tax revenue, we've got catching up to do, because everything, my payroll expense since 2019 has increased 100% in my company, 100%. And I have almost the exact same payroll. I mean, in terms of number of employees. So, and part of that is the fact that during COVID, you know, there was basically a workers' revolt where people weren't willing. Now, City Hall employees, that's not going to dramatically change that. But the point is that all of our consumables, everything else has gone up dramatically as well. So you have a period of time where it's relatively stagnant in terms of revenue generation, where there was very little done to increase the amount of revenue from property taxes. And yet every year there's inflationary increases. Every year there's healthcare increases. If there is a lot of overtime, that often translates into high, like we saw last fall, higher pension payouts. And all of this, these costs kind of build up. So like those are the things that immediately stand out to me in terms of the costs and the real numbers that are kind of out of whack in alignment. You know, I look at how much we bring in from property tax, and I look at all of the buildings and the resources, and it's kind of startling to me how low it is, how much we're bringing in. I think that property tax, don't quote me, but I think it's around $160 million how much we're bringing in as a whole city. And you go downtown and you're just like, you see all these amazing buildings and all the space, and I've been down almost every street in this city, and it's like so many houses. It's like almost 100,000 buildings, you know? And, you know, I know that people feel the burden of taxes, but it's in the context of a community that feels burdened, you know? Like, I feel like if you didn't have all of these community burdens, like people had safe places to go with their kids, like Emerson Park and Delavan Grider Community Center, if those were more available, you know, or if T teenagers had safe places to hang out, if the streets were well maintained, if there were vibrant commercial corridors like Elmwood and Hurdle on the east side and, you know, on the west side and on all of the different neighborhoods. It don't have to be as long as Elmwood. It can be a couple blocks where you have stores and a couple different restaurants and a couple different grocery options. Like, it doesn't have to be on that same scale, but it's a livable, serviceable neighborhood. If it felt like it was a community, like you, when you walked into City Hall, you felt cared for and heard. If you had elected officials that responded to you and then did something about it and were proactive and visionary. I mean, maybe I'm living in utopia, you know? I mean, maybe that's utopia. But for me, that's just healthy life. And if we have that, we're not always trying to grapple and catch up. And maybe if we had that feeling and that culture, we would have a better, you know, self-confidence about our city. You know, when I came to Buffalo in 2005, people on Buffalo Rising, right here, renewal. Oh, people have tried to reuse building materials. It was a disaster. It never works. You can't do it, right? I'm like, that's funny to hear that approach and that attitude and that response from the community when I know, like, most people, right? But we kind of get stuck in that sometimes, even though we know we live in an amazing city with so much to offer. Like, sometimes we are lacking that self-confidence and that belief in ourselves. I even have those moments where I lack, but I think that that's where the opportunity of leadership comes in, is to give people hope and belief that this is a hell of a place. And when I talk to people, you know, house parties and out on the street, everybody believes it in every corner of the city, even on the east side in neighborhoods where you'd be like, they believe it. I talked to two guys on Saturday morning out on the street, and they're like, we just want to get into that building because then we can open, you know, we want to have a Harris salon there. Like, they want to be part of the solution. They're not sitting there hopeless and tired and feeling defeated. Like, they're not feeling that way. I mean, it can be that way sometimes. But it's only that way because everywhere you turn, you're getting the door slammed in your face. How about we have a culture where we celebrate each community and we like open doors and we talk about possibilities and we articulate a vision and we say, we're going to do this together. And people are going to show up. They're going to fucking show up. Like, they're just going to be there. I just know it because I've seen it in every neighborhood and in every effort that I did. When we get in the neighborhood and we articulate a vision, people show up and they show up in force. And that has to be the attitude of the next mayor. It just has to be the vision. Or we'll be here 20 years from now and bitching about the same stuff.
I would agree that what I've seen in my experience in real estate and projects that happen in the city, and it relates to what you're touching on with the taxes, is that all these little projects create community, create neighborhoods, create density in their own way. But all those little projects are actually paying taxes.
Yeah.
All the big projects, they've all got 10-year tax breaks. Right. They're all, and that's, so that is part of. And so that's, I think that's a topic for another time, but it gets into the property tax system, which I think if the only way to make those big projects work is that they don't pay taxes, then the whole system is flawed.
Right.
So anyway, thanks for the conversation, and we will see you next time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.